And now I'm joined by Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. Good morning, Taoiseach.
Morning, Brendan. Thanks for having me.
So, celebrating, if that's the word, 2 years as Taoiseach this week, and they weren't quite midterms, but you had elections recently. You had good European elections. We'll put that aside. Were you disappointed with Fine Gael's performance in the local elections?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a celebration. I'm not really a guy for anniversaries, but it does make you think, obviously, and reflect a bit. And
did the local election results make you think and reflect a bit?
Not in the way you may think. First of all, we did have a really good European elections. Five seats, 30% of the vote. More seats than Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin, the Greens and Labour combined, so that's about as good as it gets. The locals, we gained seats and gained support.
But I suppose you didn't gain what you had hoped to gain, did
no,
you?
No, that's true. Now, it's the first time a party in government gained seats in 20 years, which isn't a small thing. We probably had targeted maybe another 15, 20 seats that we were close to, but didn't get over the line. And as is always the case in any election, whether you do well or whether you do badly or whether you do middling, you have to assess what that means. And
what do you
in
think
some
it
places
means?
We need to assess it. Well, the fact that a party that is now in its ninth year in government is gaining seats and votes is reassuring, actually. Usually government parties get a pasting in midterm elections and can still go on to get re-elected. That would have been the Fianna Fáil experience for a long time when they were in office under Bertie Ahern, for example. But I think definitely in Dublin, a lot of votes that might have come our way in maybe some of the better off areas of Dublin voted Green. Need to consider what that means and respond to that very clear message from the public that they want more done on environmental and quality of life issues generally, not just climate action, a bigger agenda there. So need to do that, basically.
And Fianna Fáil did very well in Dublin as well?
Not as well as us. We got more seats than them, but they did better
for them.
Again, for them they did well. And what's interesting about that, and again, this wasn't really foreseen by anyone, is that Sinn Féin did really badly. They lost half their seats. The far left, People Before Profit, all of them, they lost more than half their seats. So the recovering economy has caused people in many ways to turn their back on the left and the far left, largely because people's living standards are better, but they haven't come to the government in big numbers. They've probably gone back to Fianna Fáil, particularly on the north side of Dublin, and didn't see that coming. And there's an issue for that in us as to why, you know, the fact that people are back at work, unemployment is almost, we're now in full employment almost, the fact that, you know, wages are increasing, the fact that people have more money in their pockets, them going to Fianna Fáil rather than to us.
Yeah, what do you think that is?
Is something we need to analyse? I don't know. That's something we need to give some thought to.
In terms of a general election, obviously there's been...
To go back to the parties that gave you FEMPI, the USC and unemployment... Is strange, but there must be a reason about it, and the electorate are never wrong. So we need to think about that.
If they're going back to that party that you portray in that light, does it not say something that they're turning their backs on you for a party like that?
Potentially, yeah. So yeah. That's what I mean, and that's
so. In terms of a general election, then there's been a certain amount of confusion around it, and I know you were misinterpreted, and I know as well that it's not completely within your control because confidence in supply and everything. But in your mind, if it's up to you, do I take it there will not be a general election this year?
Yeah, if it's up to me, and you've rightly pointed out it's not necessarily up to me, it's a minority government. If it's up to me, my position is exactly what it was this time last year ago when I suggested to Micheál Martin that we should agree on an election date in the summer of 2020. That'd be the summer of next year. The Dáil will almost be up anyway at that stage. We have to have the election by February of 2021. So I suggested a summer election 2020, and I suggested that we sit down and agree on, you know, 10 or 20 things so we can get done between now or then. That offer was rejected. Micheál decided to link the future of this government and the future of this Dáil to Brexit, and that's where we currently stand. But my personal preference is exactly what it was last summer when I made that offer.
Okay. Do you think, to go back to the locals for a second, did the saga around Maria Bailey's personal injury case against the Dean Hotel, did that actually affect Fine Gael badly?
I think that's impossible to quantify. It definitely wasn't a plus. at the very least, it took attention away from the kind of messages that we were trying to put across in the last week. So, you know, candidates were being asked about it on the doors when they probably wanted to talk about the good things they wanted to do for their local community. And any time we were doing a press conference, we were being, you know, asked about that rather than other issues. So I'm sure it had an effect. It's not possible to quantify what that was, but mm-hmm. not a positive effect, certainly.
Did you subsequently hear her interview on Sean O'Rourke?
I did.
How did you feel when you heard that?
I felt really bad for her because Maria Bailey is a human being. She's a mother. She's a colleague. She is a hardworking TD. She's one of the more competent, one of the better ones, one of the up and coming ones in my view. And I thought it was ill advised, and I thought she did herself harm, and I felt really bad for her.
Do you think, in a way, around all of this, was Maria Bailey actually treated quite unfairly?
By whom?
By certain colleagues of hers, by the press, by social media, by the public, by the general discourse around it. She took quite a hammering, didn't she?
She did, yeah. Like, there was a bit of a frenzy around it. The stuff on social media was horrible. But if you're in politics, you need to be pretty resilient around that, because it's always pretty horrible, quite frankly, particularly on Twitter. And you just need to be thick-skinned and realise that's the way some people are in the world. Unfortunately, it's not the majority, but they're there. I thought some of it was overboard, but it doesn't take away from the fact that behind that, this was a real story. You know, in fairness, the journalist who reported it, you know, wasn't made up. But what we're doing now is an investigation in the party to find out what the full facts of this are. And I'm around long enough to know that what's in the media isn't always the full story. And we want to get the full story before we decide how to act next.
And report is due back in the last day or two. You haven't seen it yet.
I don't yet. I haven't yet. And we're following due process around that. So learning from previous events, the report is done. And then Maria will be the first to see it, and will be the first to be allowed to comment on it before I see it. And that follows on from the Guerin report, which you may be familiar with. And it's just due process. And everyone, no matter who they are, is entitled to due process and a fair hearing.
And meanwhile, Maria Bailey was back chairing the Housing Committee last week. And I think there was a sense among some people okay, it's back to business as usual. Will there be sanctions taken against Maria Bailey depending on the results of this report? Sanctions are available to you?
But that will depend on the report, and there's a scale of possible options there. But you know, I don't want to be talking about that on the radio before I've had a chance to speak to read the report and see her about it. But there is behind this a serious issue, a real issue that we're trying to grapple with, which mm-hmm. is the cost of insurance.
Have you spoken to Alan Farrell about his compensation case?
I have, yeah.
And will there be a report into that?
No, it's a somewhat different one. He was rear-ended. The other driver accepted liability. The case was heard, and there was a very modest settlement in his favour.
And the judge awarded him €2,500 and said there was little or no notation to back up a claim of significant whiplash. So he was found in favour. Mm. But, I mean, the bottom line is, for a party and a government that is supposed to be tackling compo culture, which is an issue that is, you know, the public are very exercised about, this kind of thing doesn't look good, does it?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And that's something I have to deal with. I have to deal with the fact that I have a political party with 300 elected representatives, TDs, senators, councillors, MEPs. They are all individuals. It's not an army, and they often do these things without recourse to the party or the agreement of the party. But one of the things we're actually going to change, and this is our party pledge, is we are going to make it a requirement now for all candidates to make us aware of previous convictions or court cases they may be getting involved in, because you know, we can't just treat these things as private matters anymore, because they do have an impact on the rest of the party, many of whom shouldn't bear the consequences of this. But like I say, the real focus and the most important thing I think for people listening to this is that we do something to bring down their insurance costs, and we've had some progress in motor insurance. It's about 25% down from the peak. Health insurance, which had been rising every year, doesn't anymore. That's going down a bit, or staying the same. The one we've a real difficulty with now is public liability insurance for business people. And you know, for anyone, for every person in Fine Gael who made a claim, there's 10 or 20 people in Fine Gael who own a business, and they're mm-hmm. not happy about this at all, as you can imagine. And a lot of business people support us because we're a pro-business party.
And then, in a sense,
and we need to get on top of that.
Sorry, yeah. Have we tended, I wonder, in a sense as well, for this, the narrative around this to be that this is the fault of people taking claims. We saw this week, the insurance companies post massive profits for 2017. They have some responsibility on their side of this as well, haven't they? Are you talking to them?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and it's more than talking. It's a pretty robust engagement, and there's a number of things the insurance industry are demanding. For example, more investigations around fraud. They want the book of quantum change so that the judiciary brings down the volume of claims. And we're saying to them, we're only going to do those type of things if you're going to give us an assurance that we're actually going to reduce the premiums. Like, we're not doing this so you guys can make bigger profits.
And are they giving that assurance?
It has to be tested.
Okay. So
yes and no, I would
okay.
say.
Do they want,
and we're talking
they want
to the judiciary
you to take all
well,
the action first before they will then come through with their side of it?
There's a bit of that, yeah. And that's not satisfactory. But one thing, you know, we do need to do is the term people love to use in government buildings for these types of things is multifactorial. There's no one reason why insurance premiums in Ireland are higher than they are in similar countries. There's probably about 10, and you need to kind of poke at all of those 10 issues to bring down premiums. And like I say, we've brought them down in motor insurance, still too high, but we've brought them down. I think we can do it in public liability as well. But part of that is going to be tackling the combo culture and exaggerated claims as much as false claims, and working with the judiciary to make sure that the awards are realistic and reasonable, because they're much higher than they should be, and also putting the hard word on the insurance industry that, okay, you know, Ireland isn't Treasure Island for you. If we're going to make these reforms, people need to see their premiums go down, and that's what we expect.
Now, speaking of Treasure Island, Fine Gael is, of course, as we hear all the time, traditionally portrayed as the party of fiscal prudence. So this week, the Fiscal Advisory Council came out and said that your medium-term spending plans are not credible, which is a strong wording. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think, you know, we have to listen to what IFAC, the Fiscal Advisory Council, has to say. We have to heed their warnings. We set them up for this reason, to be the watchdog, and the watchdog is barking. Everyone else is demanding more spending. I guarantee you, I go into the Dáil every day, and the opposition demands more spending. I open the papers and all the commentators say we're not doing enough on X, Y, and Z, and doing more means spending more. Unions, NGOs, everyone calls for more spending. It's good that we have a body that's saying, well, actually, maybe you're increasing spending a bit too quickly. And I remember 12 years ago when the European Commission warned the then government that it was increasing spending too quickly and was over-reliant on stamp duty. The government at the time, you know, dismissed the warnings, rubbished people who put across those warnings. I'm not going to make the same mistake.
Okay, so Pascal Donoghue did say he was taking their advice on board. What did you take on board specifically from what they had to say this week?
Okay, two things. First of all, it's okay for spending to continue to grow. You know, we need to invest in infrastructure and housing and healthcare and education. We have a growing population, but we need to make sure that we don't allow spending to increase too fast. So we need to make sure that the spending increases are more in the range of 4 or 5% than 7 or 8. And the second thing is, we are doing really well in terms of receipts of corporation profit tax. Companies that maybe didn't pay a lot of tax in the past are now paying an awful lot of tax. We can't assume that money will always be there.
But we are tending, aren't we, to use that money for current spending, use that money as if it will be there again?
Not quite. The kind of things we are doing, for example, is the rainy day fund. And the money from corporation profit tax is going into the rainy day fund.
How much of it?
It'll be 500 million this year and then every year.
Yeah, 500 million of 10 billion.
Yeah,
six billion of which IFAC say might not be there in the next year or two, or could be at risk. It's like, well, it's 20% of our
taxation.
Say
between three and six. And
yeah.
A big difference,
okay,
between 3 and 6.
But we're putting away yeah, half a billion of it. It's, yeah, it's probably not enough, is it?
Yeah, that's one of the three things we're doing. The second thing is running a surplus. And for the first time since 2006, we ran a budget surplus. Last year, we will run a bigger surplus, and actually, provided the economy continues to grow, we'll run bigger surpluses every year. So that's about a surplus. This surplus this year, next year could be about $1 billion. And then as well as that, if you read the budget for this year, we actually built the budget projecting that corporation profit tax receipts in 2019 will be lower than they were in 2018. Now, they probably actually won't, but we wrote into our projections a fall this year just in case that happens. So they're the three things we're doing. But I think when you look at these things, and you should look at them in the round, there's lots of reasons for believing that the economy is being well managed, and the public finances are well managed. You know, we are running a budget surplus for the first time in a long time. We're taking more in revenues than we're spending. We are reducing the national debt, which had been quadrupled by the opposition when they were in government. That's now coming down. We've full employment. We've rising incomes, according to CSO, falling levels of poverty, falling levels of deprivation. The European Commission signed off on our budgets, said that we did meet our fiscal rules, and the rating agencies are giving us a AAA rating. So, you know, there's lots of reasons to say that we're managing things well, but we can't ignore a watchdog which is barking, because we have been here in the past as a country, and the scars of the last financial crash, they're still there, and we need to make sure that we do the right thing, and that means saying no to demands for additional spending. Sometimes we'll have to do that, but we're doing that for the right reasons, because I never want to ever have to ask people ever again to accept a pay cut or cut the minimum wage or cut welfare or anything like that. And that's why we'll have to make some of these decisions that people may find lacking compassion, but we're doing this for the right reasons.
Does that mean we're looking at a tighter budget this time? You promised at the Fine Gael Ardèche that you were going to cut taxes over the next 5 years until everybody wasn't paying the higher marginal rate until they got over earnings of 50,000. Does that mean that's all off the table now?
No, it's not off, but it does mean that this budget coming, this particular budget coming, will need to be tighter than the last one in terms of the extent to which we increase spending. Now, bear in mind, IFAC hasn't actually criticised us on income tax or USC. In fact, what we've done on income tax and USC is we've reduced it by a tiny bit, a small amount, in the last three budgets, worth about €1,500 to the average household. Not big money, but not small money either.
So are we looking at a tougher budget this time then?
By tougher, I do not mean tax increases and spending cuts, but by tougher, we won't be able to increase spending by as fast as we did in the last budget.
I suppose,
and bear in mind, one thing we really have to bear in mind with this budget is it's going to happen in the first week of October, first or second week of October. We don't know what's going to happen on the 31st of October. The potential is there, growing risk, in fact, of a no-deal Brexit.
So have you two budgets
ready? This
won't
be a normal budget. That's what we're doing at the moment. Yeah, we're developing two budgets for two different scenarios. One being a hard Brexit no deal, in which case we won't have to worry about the economy overheating. We'll be in a totally different environment if that happens. The economy will slow down dramatically. That's one budget, and the other budget is for one where we have a deal and the economy continues to grow and we continue to have these capacity issues around full employment and risk of inflation and so on. And we will decide at some point in September which of those two budgets we're going to go for.
Okay, I suppose a lot of people's problem is with what they see of the manner of how money is being spent. So, you know, the National Children's Hospital became a kind of a lightning rod for questions around your reputation for prudence. So we learned this week the final bill might top $2 billion. The chair of the Development Board, Fred Barry, he seemed to be saying to the Dáil Committee during the week, look, this is just how things are. It's going to go up. There's going to be delays. And, you know, delays cost millions more a month. And that's just how it is with these projects. Have you any control over this?
We do. We don't have control over things like inflation. You know, the cost of building is linked to lots of things like the cost of materials and the cost of labour, and we don't control things like that, for example, but there are other things that we do control, and the contract allows for an increase if construction inflation is more than 4%, mm-hmm. not less than 4%, more than 4%, and we'll see how that pans out over the next few years. But, you know, I think, again, it's only fair to look at these things in the round. Yesterday I was opening the next phase of the National Sports Campus, Came in on time on budget.
Do you not see what
the Irish Water Programme, the roads programme, the schools programme, all of these things are coming in on time and on budget.
If we go back to the Children's Hospital, can you not see how people feel that that is completely out of control? The cost of it had doubled by the time it materialised at all, and now the costs seem to be spiralling up and up, and we're being told, well, this is just how it is.
I totally understand that, and that's one of the worries that we have in government too, because every time the cost of the Children's Hospital rises, there's an opportunity cost. There's other things that we might like to do that we then can't do. So, you know, we're putting in place some really good people. Fred Barry, I asked him personally to chair that board because he was the guy that I worked with when I was Minister for Transport as head of the National Roads Authority, which started off not doing things on time and on budget. And by the time he was finished, things were happening on time.
And
on
in terms of good people, who's the new project manager?
I don't think we have one yet, but I think that's gone out to competition.
Yeah, according to the Irish Times yesterday, John Pollock is stepping down this month, and it will be several months before a new project manager is in place.
Yeah, we're going to need to find a good one and somebody who's a good record of making sure that things come in on time and on budget.
Are you happy with the project drifting on for a few months without a project manager, given the history of it and given the way the costs are spiralling? Are you not annoyed about that?
It's far from ideal, but you know, there's a whole management team there. It's not just one project manager. There's a whole executive team there. But you know, one thing I think I just hope won't be lost in all of this is the enormous value of this project. You know, a new children's hospital. I know, don't shut me down on this.
No.
A new children's hospital is something that was promised when I was a medical student. The last government, Fianna Fáil and the Greens, spent 30 or 40 million on building it in the matter and abandoned the project. This is actually being built. The first phase, which is the satellite centre in Blanchardstown, will open this year. You know, this is for real. If you look at the site in James's, it's now at two stories. You know, this is actually going to happen. This is going to be a healthcare asset for our children for the next 100 or 200 years. And when people go into it, when they see it, when they see how much it's going to transform paediatric healthcare in Ireland, nobody will be sorry we built it. And it's for real.
How much do you think it'll end up costing, and how much is too much?
Yeah, you see, that often depends what you include. You know, when I see figures of 1.7 billion and 2 billion, I think people assume that that's the cost of the building beside James's. When people use those kind of figures, they're actually using the entire project. They're including equipment, ICT, they're including the satellite centre in Blanchardstown, they're including the satellite centre in Talla, they're even including the 30 or 40 million was wasted by Fianna Fáil and the Greens on the matter. So they're even including the cost of the move from the three other hospitals. So you can get to those kind of figures, but you have to include all of that as well. And I think that's a bit misleading, quite frankly.
On a smaller scale, the Waterford Airport project, this is an airport we're told hasn't seen a commercial flight in 3 years. You are supporting giving 5 million to extend the runway there. And this is apparently against the advice of officials in the Department of Public Expenditure.
Yes. And the job of politicians is to listen to advice and to make a decision. And very often we have contrary advice, by the way. You'll have one department advising one thing, the other department advising the other, and then three external groups advising something else. So, you know, you don't just listen to one set of advice and go along with it. You have to hear different advice. And the natural default position understandably, of the Department of Public Expenditure, which is there to control expenditure, is to say no to expenditure. There's lots of other areas of expenditure which they oppose too, which people would be quite shocked to hear they oppose, particularly in the area of health, where they would be reining back lots of things that the general public value very deeply. But this to deal with this particular issue, Waterford Airport is the Coast Guard base, so it needs to stay open. It doesn't have commercial flights anymore, largely because the runway is too small for modern planes. So this is an investment. Most of the money is not coming from central government. Private investors are willing to put in money and put in first, and the three local authorities are willing to put money on the table as well. And that's what makes it quite unusual and also quite an encouraging proposition, because, you know, the fact that private investors, the private sector is willing to put money in, local businesses, the three local authorities are willing to put money in, government is only being asked to put in less than half of the money. And I think it's something we should give a try. the Waterford region, the South East region needs a boost. And among the things we need to do there, I believe, is trying to get the airport up and running again, deliver on the Technological University in the South East. And one of the things we're doing, for example, and this is again against official advice, is putting in a second CAT lab into the hospital. And I know a lot of people in Waterford sometimes feel that officialdom always seems to advise against things in the South East and things in Waterford, and I wouldn't sometimes blame them for feeling that way.
John Halligan said, if people want to say it's parish pump politics, I don't care. It's a big hit for the South East. Is it parish pump politics?
No, and it's not a parish. It's a region. You know, Waterford is a city. It's a city that we aim to double in population by 2040, and it's at the centre of a region involving Wexford, Kilkenny, Waterford and South Tipperary. You know, if this was happening in Shannon or Dublin, would people be calling it parish pump?
I guess there's a perception that it's a ghost airport right now, but however.
Yeah, but how do you change? How do you fix that? It is a ghost airport. At the moment, the Coast Guard operate from it, and there's a certain amount of general aviation. How do you make it function again if you don't invest in it?
Okay. We heard research this week about homelessness, that living in hotels is having a destructive impact on homeless children. There are children who are not hitting milestones like crawling and walking because of the situations they're living in. What do you say to those families?
Well, first of all, I think it's very, very distressing. And, you know, I've met some of these families, either in my constituency work or visiting family hubs, for example, and emergency accommodation. And I know that the public finds the situation of family homelessness in particular to be offensive, and I do too. And we need to do much more for them. One of the things we're doing is trying to minimise the amount of time that people spend in a B&B or a hotel, and that's through the whole family hub programme. And they're not a long-term solution, but they're much better. And I've been to them, and, you know, you have your own kitchens, you have play areas. You know, it's a much better situation than a hotel. And also, we're now well into what is the biggest social housing programme in decades. Added 9,000 houses last year to the social housing stock. Half of them built, the other half bought or leased. We'll get that up to about 10,000 this year. So after a very long time of almost no investment in social housing, we now have the biggest social housing programme in decades. It's going to take time before it works, but it will work.
Yet the homelessness figures are still going up.
They are. I suppose this isn't much of a defence that they're not going up as fast as they were. They kind of levelled off over the past year at in around 10,000, but that's not good enough. They need to be falling. We haven't turned the corner yet, but I think we will, largely because of the massive social housing programme that's underway and also because of what we've done around tenants' rights. If you look at the reasons why people become homeless, there's lots of different ones. Some of it's down to family breakdown, but a lot of it is also down to people being issued a notice to quit by their landlord. And just in the last couple of weeks, we've enhanced tenants' rights so that if somebody is asked to leave by their landlord because they're selling on or because they're moving a family member back in, they have to get much more time to find alternative accommodation. And that will actually help us working with the agencies and the NGOs to prevent people becoming homeless in the first place, which is really what we need to do, because we're actually getting a lot of people out of homelessness, but people are becoming homeless at much the same rate.
Do you think Owen Murphy is on top of this situation? I think he's a good minister for housing.
I do, yeah. Yeah, I think he gets a hard time, and some of the stuff about him is very personalised, and I don't think that's right. But he's a really hard-working minister. It's not just him, it's Damien English, who's in that department too. They're doing a very good job, and I don't honestly believe that there's anyone who'd be doing a better job.
There has been talk recently about a cabinet reshuffle. Are you still thinking of a cabinet reshuffle?
Not at the moment. It's, you know, it's always the prerogative of any Taoiseach to reshuffle their team, and subject to the approval of the Dáil, of course. But not going to do that at the moment. You know, we're heading into the summer recess, but we're also heading into a budget and potentially a game-changing situation around Brexit at the end of October. And I don't want people who need to learn on the job during that period.
On the 9 o'clock news on Wednesday, Lorraine Walsh of the 221 Plus campaign said in relation to the cervical check scandal that no one had ever apologised to them on behalf of the state for what happened. Will there be an official state apology to these women?
I I had thought we had. Certainly, I think in previous comments that I've made, I've apologised for what has happened, particularly the whole scandal around non-disclosure, the failure of the HSE and Circlecheck, which are public bodies, failing to engage in open disclosure to tell the women about the audit. That was an appalling scandal and was wrong. And on behalf of the state, I'm certainly sorry for it. If perhaps there's a particular format in which that should be done, such as a statement in the Dáil, if that hasn't been done already, I'm happy to do it. But absolutely. But the focus of government has been on many other things, putting in place the package of supports for all of those women and their families.
Yeah.
The Scally inquiry, which was really important that we got that done first, and he does a really good job. And the other thing that I'm really committed to and I want to get done is to become the government that put us on the road to eliminating cervical cancer as a cancer, because it's an awful cancer, and we can virtually eliminate it, and that's by doing things like encouraging parents to take up the HPV vaccine for girls. It's extending it to boys. That is happening in September. It's also about improving the screening system, moving towards a new test that's more accurate. No test is 100% accurate, by the way, but a screening test that's more accurate, and we're making good progress on that. And that's above all what I would like to come out of the whole cervical check controversy, is something good. And I think the two good things that could come out of it are eliminating cervical cancer for the next generation, and secondly, making our health service a much more open and honest place. And that can be done too, particularly around making open disclosure in serious cases mandatory.
Okay, I think 221 Plus would like an officially framed state apology. I think their feeling is there have been apologies to some individuals. Mm. There have been various forms of apology given. There are a lot of the women who, we don't know their names or who these women are. They weren't public and everything, and I think a lot of them feel that they were never apologised to.
Well, I think the best thing we can do on foot of that, and we do have an engagement with 221, and they receive funding from government for a lot of their work, is for me to ask Minister Harris to engage with them on what format and appropriate apology they would like and would find useful, and I'd be very, very happy to do that, and I think it would be appropriate.
Okay, can I read some texts? We need people in homes, not hubs. Putting people in hotels is absolutely unacceptable, so moving to hubs is not a great achievement. Action is way too slow. We've had these issues for years. Wasting money on a ghost airport, spend that 5 million on housing, that texter says. There is a terrible frustration out there, isn't there, around homelessness? It keeps growing, and it's not working.
Well, we're actually, there's the mention there of the 5 million investment in Waterford Airport. We're putting 2,600 million into housing this year. That just to give you the perspective of the government's priorities, 2,600 million, the biggest housing budget ever. And we will, in Ireland this year, probably build more than somewhere between 22,000 and 25,000 homes, more than in a decade. I know it's not happening fast enough, but we don't want to do it in such a way that cuts corners. We don't want to go back to ghost estates or Pyrite or Mica or Priory Hall or any of those things that we had in the past. So we need to do this properly, and we need to do this in a way that doesn't cut corners. And one thing I'd like us to talk about a little bit more is the whole issue of home ownership, because I'm a big believer in home ownership. About 70% of people in Ireland own their own homes, and I want that to be reality for people who are now in their 20s and 30s, just as it was for my age group when we were in our 20s and 30s. We were able to buy our own homes, and that has to be a big focus of policy too. And I know there are a lot of people getting very ideological, and they're against private housing and they're against private developers and all the rest of it, but actually most people in Ireland want to own their own home. They want to have a private house, and you need a private developer to build that private house, and that's one of the areas I think we need to focus on as well.
Okay, can I read one more text? Ask Leo why he was so rude and condescending towards Gino Kenny in the Dáil the medicinal cannabis inquiry. It was disgusting behaviour from an unelected leader of our country towards a colleague. So this was Gino Kenny was asking you about medicinal cannabis, and he told you, I think, about a particular story or situation that he was dealing with, and you didn't stand up to answer him, and you just said two words. You said same answer, and it was perceived by a lot of people to be a bit rude and dismissive.
Yeah. Look, I'm sorry if it came across that way. I certainly wouldn't want to be dismissive of any individual case or any individual person who's waiting for the Cannabis Access Programme, and that's coming. Medicinal cannabis is now legal in Ireland. You need a prescription from a specialist. Then the minister gives you a licence, and we're trying to improve that through an access programme. But what is so often the case, particularly when it comes to social media, is people can take a 5-second clip out of context. And what happened there is the question had already been asked. I had already answered it. And the procedure in the House is that a deputy isn't supposed to ask the same question twice, because that prevents somebody else from getting their question in because time is limited. And I thought that was actually disrespectful of him to other colleagues who had questions to ask in that time slot that hadn't already been answered. And I'm not sure if you ever watched the House of Commons, but the House of Commons has this procedure whereby if a TD or an MP in their case asks the same question, the Prime Minister stands up and says, "I refer the Honourable Gentleman to the answer I gave some moments ago," and nobody thinks that's awful. Everyone just understands that the reason why you ask a question, or at least you should ask a question in the Dáil, is because you want an answer, not because you want a video clip that you can then use to make somebody else look bad.
Now, before we finish up, we should talk about what's going on with our neighbours across the water. You said this week you're a little concerned at developments in London. You said it's a terrible political miscalculation for people to think they can get a better Brexit deal because the last one wasn't ratified. Are we 100% confident here the EU is not going to budge on this?
Yes. One of the features of the past 2 years has been European unity. I think a lot of people underestimated the capacity of 27 member states in the European Union to stay united, and we have. And it's not just out of solidarity with Ireland, although that is part of it. It's also an understanding that the European Union is in negotiations all the time with lots of different bodies and lots of different countries, whether it's trade negotiations with Japan, whether it's, talks about security with Russia. And the last thing we can ever do is allow any non-member, and the UK is going to be a non-member, to think that they can somehow divide us or pick us apart.
Are we in danger at all of this leading us to a no-deal situation, which would be absolutely catastrophic and obviously much worse than not getting a backstop?
Of course that's a risk. But to me, no backstop is effectively the same as no deal. Because what the backstop is it's a legal guarantee and a legally operable guarantee that we will never see a hard border emerge again between Northern Ireland and Ireland, and that the rights and freedoms of Irish citizens and European citizens in Northern Ireland will be protected if we don't have that.
To give a time limit, say, on a backstop would be equally as bad as a no-deal Brexit on the 31st of October?
The difficulty we have with the time limit is that effectively you're then saying that there will or could be a hard border once that time limit expires, and that isn't a backstop. What we are open to, and we've always been open to this, by the way, is this idea of alternative arrangements, that perhaps we can avoid a hard border between North and South through alternative arrangements, procedures, technology and so on. And that's actually in the political declaration, so it's not that we've ever had a problem with that. But what we expect, and I don't think this is unreasonable, is we want to see that fleshed out. We want to see it exist. We want to see it demonstrated before we're willing to give up the backstop. And what people seem to be saying is that, give up our time limit, the backstop, which we know will work legally and operationally, in return for something that doesn't yet exist but might exist in the future. And I can't do that to the border communities. I can't do that to the people in Northern Ireland.
What did you think
of Boris? And bear in mind, the people in Northern Ireland want the backstop.
Boris Johnson, who is, it would seem right now, hot favourite to be the next PM, was talking yesterday about, I guess, resurrecting the notion of maximum facilitation and alternative arrangements whereby the border checks would happen but not on a border. Was that hopeful to hear that?
Again, we've always been open to alternative arrangements. They're written into the political declaration. It's part of the package that was agreed with Prime Minister May. But we need to understand what they are, how they would work. We'd need to see them demonstrated, really, before we could give up what's proposed in the backstop. And there's, you
was
know,
it a positive note to hear him talk about that yesterday?
I want to be careful not to be intervening in an ongoing race for the leadership of the British Conservative Party. Whenever there is a new Prime Minister in place, you know, I look forward to talking to them and seeing if we can come to a solution. You know, we all want, obviously, ideally, I wouldn't like the UK to leave at all, but if they are going to leave, we want them to leave in an orderly way. We all want to avoid a hard border. We all want to protect the rights of citizens, and we all want a transition period. There's a lot we agree on. I think I look forward to meeting the Prime Minister, the new Prime Minister, whenever that new Prime Minister is elected, and we'll take it from there.
But you are concerned about the talk around the Tory leadership race,
well,
are you?
I'm concerned at the idea, and there is an idea there in Westminster and London that somehow Theresa May was a bad negotiator and got a bad deal. That's not true. She was a good negotiator. She had a good team. She probably got the best deal she could get, given that a country leaving the European Union doesn't have much leverage. The fact that the failure of the House of Commons to ratify the withdrawal agreement somehow means that they're going to get a better deal, like, that's just not how the European Union works. It's also not how negotiation works. If we allowed that, wouldn't every parliament do that? Like, say we did a trade deal with Canada, or we came to a security agreement with Turkey, and then the Turkish parliament or the Canadian parliament said, no, go back and get a better deal. And we gave them a better deal. It's just not how negotiations
work.
But
the increased talk around no deal from several of the candidates must be alarming, is it?
It is alarming. And we've always recognised that no deal is a potential outcome. That's why we've done so much preparations about it. You know, back in March, we passed all the laws we needed to pass to prepare for no deal. We have hundreds of people now hired in Revenue and Customs to implement no deal if we need to. We've issued, or at least made available, hundreds of millions in low-cost loans for business to make adaptations that may be necessary if we have no deal. And we did all of that, understanding that no deal is a real possibility, and it is a real possibility, and we do it understanding that no deal will be a damage limitation exercise for Ireland. It'll be about limiting the damage to our economy, but also understanding as well that if we end up in a no deal scenario, there will inevitably be negotiations, I think, after that. And the European Union has always said that if no deal happens, the first three things on the agenda for any negotiations with the UK will be citizens' rights, the financial settlement, and Ireland. So anyone in London who thinks that no deal allows them to get out of those three issues, they're wrong. They will be the first three issues on the agenda, which will have to be resolved before anything else is.
Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, thank you very much, and we'll take a break.